This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The crew performed all the procedures repeatedly provided by the manufacturer, but was not able to control the aircraft.
That's Dagmawit Moges, Ethiopia's Minister of Transport, discussing the preliminary report on the Ethiopian plane crash. Details coming up. Also, Ugandan security forces are still searching for an American tourist, her driver, and the four gunmen who abducted them inside a national park. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A preliminary report on last month's crash of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft in Ethiopia has been released in Addis Ababa. It says pilots aboard the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 followed all emergency procedures but were unable to control the aircraft, which went down soon after takeoff from the Ethiopian capital, killing all 157 people. Ryan Bohr reports.
At a news conference Thursday in Addis, Ethiopia's Ministry of Transportation revealed the initial findings of its investigations into the crash. The findings, which were based on information from the aircraft's flight data and cockpit voice recorders, exonerated the Ethiopian Airlines crew. Dagmawit Moges, Ethiopia's Minister of Transport, addressed reporters.
The following facts have been determined. Number one, the aircraft possessed a valid certificate of airworthiness. The second one, the crew obtained the license and qualifications to conduct the flight. And third, the takeoff roll appeared very normal. And the fourth one is, the crew performed all the procedures repeatedly provided by the manufacturer, but was not able to control the aircraft.
The committee set up to investigate the crash included representatives from the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board, Ethiopian Airlines, Ethiopia's Civil Aviation Authority, France's Bureau of Inquiry and Analysis for Civil Aviation Safety, and the European Union Aviation Safety Agency. Ethiopian Airlines also released a statement Thursday saying the report clearly showed that the plane persistently nosedived and that the flight crew followed the emergency procedures recommended by Boeing and approved by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. Moges said the investigation pointed towards a possible fault on the aircraft that caused the nose to point downward. She said Boeing should investigate the automated flight control system linked to the crash.
Based on this initial information gathered during the course of investigation, two safety recommendations has been forwarded in the preliminary report. The first one is, since repetitive uncommanded aircraft nose down conditions are noticed in this preliminary investigation, it is recommended that the aircraft flight control system related to the flight controllability shall be reviewed by the manufacturer. And the second one is, aviation authorities shall verify that the review of the aircraft flight control system related to flight controllability has been adequately addressed by the manufacturer before release of the aircraft to operations.
Osman Abdullahi, a relative of one of the crash victims, told VOA that the preliminary report brings him a step closer to closure.
The incident has happened, so we just leave it there to God. I think that is precaution to other people. Before the plane takes off, it should be checked thoroughly.
In October of last year, another Boeing 737 MAX 8 crashed in Indonesia. Both crashes have been linked to a new flight control system that Boeing installed on the MAX series of jets. Even before investigations were done, the similarities between the two crashes prompted governments and airlines worldwide to ground all of their MAX 8 fleets, the newest passenger aircraft made by Boeing. A full report on the latest crash will be issued by the government within 1 year. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Boeing today said it will study the crash report and take all steps needed to ensure safety. It also said it is preparing an update to the software and pilot training for the 737 MAX jets. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has appealed for restraint as Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army continued its westward push, raising concerns for renewed conflict in the strife-torn country. Guterres said there is no military solution as he arrived in Tripoli to meet with the weak internationally recognized government in Libya. Haftar controls the east and has expanded his clout into the south and some key oil fields. Haftar's forces have taken full control of Gharian, about 100 kilometers south of Tripoli. It's the closest Haftar's forces have come to Libya's capital. The United Nations and Western countries have been trying to mediate between the two factions. National conference is planned for later this month to tackle the instability and pave the way for elections. Ugandan security forces are searching for an American tourist, her driver, and the four gunmen who abducted them inside a national park yesterday. The gunmen have demanded $500,000 to release the captives. Halima Atumani has the latest from Kampala.
Ugandan police say a group of three tourists and their Ugandan driver were out in Queen Elizabeth National Park at about 2 p.m. Tuesday when the unidentified men held them up at gunpoint. They say the gunmen kidnapped an American identified as a 35-year-old Kimberly Sue Endcott and the driver Jean Paul. The other two tourists, an elderly couple, were freed and later informed park officials of the abduction. The abduction happened in the Ishasha section of the park, which sits near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Pauline Namaye is the police deputy spokesperson.
The kidnappers, using the victim's phone, have demanded $500,000. We strongly believe that this ransom is the reason behind the kidnap.
Now, the phone is switched off, meaning authorities have to wait for kidnappers to get back in touch. Security agencies, including the president's elite special forces, the tourism police and the regular police, are searching the national park, an area that covers 2,000 square kilometers, in hopes of rescuing Endcott and Paul. They are hoping the gunmen do not cross into Windy Impenetrable Forest National Park, which is just 18 kilometers from the kidnap scene and stretches into Congo. In 1999, armed Hutu fighters from Congo entered Windy Park and killed 8 tourists and 4 Ugandans. Namaya says police suspect Endcott, Paul, and the kidnappers are still somewhere in Queen Elizabeth Park.
We strongly believe that the perpetrators and the victims could still be trapped within our search area, and we are hopeful that our efforts will lead to their successful and safe recovery.
Uganda earns about $1.3 billion per year from tourism. Bashir Hanji, the spokesperson for the Uganda Wildlife Authority, acknowledged the kidnapping could hurt the tourism industry, but says tourists need to be cautious when traveling in national parks.
Maybe we need to appreciate the fact that these people, they did not have a ranger guide at the time they went for the game drive. And why do we have guns in the parks? It's to protect our visitors, not only against wildlife, but also against such illegal armed entrants in the parks.
Meanwhile, in an advisory, the U.S. Embassy in Kampala has asked Americans to exercise caution when traveling in Queen Elizabeth National Park due to ongoing security activity. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, warns the security situation in Mali will continue to spiral downward unless the international community invests more heavily in addressing the humanitarian crisis that is increasing poverty and hunger among the population. Lisa Schlein reports from OCHA headquarters in Geneva.
UN officials expect 3.8 million people in Mali will be short of food during the so-called lean season from June to August. This is the period between two harvests when food stocks are depleted. They say more than 500,000 people will be in a crisis or emergency situation. The head of the OCHA office in Mali, Uta Koli, says poverty, hunger, the impact of climate change and disputes over land and resources are some of the problems that trigger inter-ethnic violence and that are behind rising insecurity in the country. Unfortunately, she says the international response to growing violence in the country is to spend more money to beef up security rather than addressing the huge humanitarian assistance needs.
It's not that the international community does not invest in Mali. They look at Mali as a problem of terrorism, illegal migration, and so their answer is invest in military deployments, reinforce security.
Colis estimates roughly $3 billion a year is spent for UN peacekeeping forces, the G5 countries that fight terrorism in the Sahel, and other Malian armed forces. By contrast, the United Nations has appealed for $296 million for its humanitarian operations in Mali this year and has received just 9% of that amount. She says stronger political mediation efforts are crucial for ending the seemingly endless spiral of fighting. She tells VOA multiple mediation efforts currently are underway by the government, the United Nations, and various non-governmental agencies.
We need a strong leadership in that because we need to have a harmonized approach and we need to address the different conflicts in the different areas with similar kind of methodology and similar kind of messaging, and we have to act on those messages as well.
The OCHA official says it is not good enough to just talk about ways to end the conflicts. She says the underlying causes must be addressed. She says the likelihood of stopping the current spiral of deterioration will be enhanced if serious efforts are made in this direction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. As Algeria looks forward to a new leader for the first time in two decades, it's unclear if the resignation of ailing President Abdelaziz Bouteflika will ease the public demands for a new path forward. One sign is likely to come tomorrow when more anti-government protests are planned. Last week's demonstration was the largest in six consecutive Fridays, and the opposition has vowed to continue hitting the streets. But while the protests clearly played a role in the sudden political change, the opposition is likely to run into challenges in finding a viable candidate to challenge the entrenched political structure. And it's far from clear what the powerful military's reaction will be if the protests continue or even escalate. In a farewell letter, Bouteflika asked forgiveness for any failings and urged the populace to stay united and never divide yourselves. Abder Razak Bokri, chairman of the Algerian Movement of Society for Peace, says the popular movement must continue its peaceful marches to achieve its full constitutional demands. Mokri called on all political forces and elites to open serious dialogue and discussions to build the Algeria of tomorrow. Michel Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the next stage in the Algerian transition.
What I think is happening right now is that the army chief of staff and others around him in the power structure are going to try to manage a process to bring about what looks like a transition with minimal change in the actual arrangements of power. That's probably what they will try to do. The question is, what will the protesters do? Will they accept that? Will they play along, you know, and trust that process, some sort of a transition process, perhaps a constitutional process, perhaps new presidential elections with different candidates and so forth? Or will they push for more profound change? The protesters have been saying in the streets, it's not just Bouteflika, it's the system that has to change. But the question is, what we haven't seen really is a unified political leadership and some sort of very clear and specific demands from the protesters about the sort of change they want.
Without clear leadership of the Algerian uprising and rejecting and not having enough trust in the political parties in the opposition, what model would Algeria adopt, the Tunisian model or the Egyptian one?
Well, yes, Mohammed, that's an interesting question because, of course, right next door is Tunisia, which does have an ongoing and viable democratic transition, although troubled by many problems, but really still going forward. And then Egypt, of course, had what I would consider a short-circuited democratic transition that ended in 2013 with a military coup. Look, unfortunately, many of the aspects of the Algerian political situation are perhaps a little bit more similar to Egypt than Tunisia. Not everything is identical, of course. But I think that the Algerians have the ability to look at these other examples in their neighborhood to learn lessons from them. Clearly, the Tunisians learned lessons from the Egyptian failure. The Tunisia's own democratic transition was on the verge of failing in 2013, and then they saw what happened in Egypt, and the major political forces compromised and moved forward. So perhaps the Algerians likewise. You mentioned, Mohammed, that there isn't clear political leadership. That's true. But sometimes leadership emerges in situations like this, where there's a real need for it.
That was Michelle Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. And in late breaking news, Somalia's capital has been hit by another bombing near a police academy. There was no immediate word on casualties, but witnesses described the blast as huge. The car bombing occurred near a checkpoint at General Kai Police Academy in Mogadishu's Hamar Jajab district. Reuters reports it went off in a restaurant. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the extremist Al-Shabaab group has said it carried out a string of recent attacks, including a car bomb a week ago that killed at least 15 people near a hotel and restaurants. Yesterday, Somali police said a suspected car full of IEDs is on the loose and urged the public to be alert and report it to the police. As the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches on Sunday, we are bringing you a series of deeply moving profiles of men, women, and children who survived that terrible time. They are talking about the lives they lost, the lives they have found, and their hope for a new and better Rwanda. Today, the Survivor Series, we hear from Amakule Mukantabana, who lived in fear after losing her parents and two siblings in the genocide. Afterwards, she expected to die at any time, but as time passed, she decided she needed to move on. She has worked at Conseil Protestant du Rwanda, an ecumenical non-profit organization that helped her study until she obtained a master's degree in early child education and social sciences. She plans to encourage youths to work hard while avoiding laziness. Now she looks back at the last 25 years as the happiest period of her life, something she once could not have believed possible.
I lost my brother together with his wife and four children. The entire family was wiped out, and it's not only his family. In our village, there are families that have been wiped out. Unfortunately, we do not even have any of their photos. That saddens me because we can end up forgetting them. Another thing that aggrieved me is seeing a woman carrying a baby at her back, killing another boy. I was on the run. I think I had reached Muhanga. The woman had an umbrella because genocide happened in a rainy season, and used that umbrella to finish a young boy because others were beating him up too. It has been very difficult for me to forget it. It is hard to remember that the people you used to talk to, share meals together, and joke with have gone forever, have not even left behind one child, and you will never see them again. There is no way I can put this behind me. It's not easy. Then this woman, who was carrying a child on her back. I do not understand how a mother carrying a child on her back would kill another child. It is something that I felt was so contrary to life and humanity and to the mercy that usually characterizes women. Now, life is better. I commute to work every day. Those who were children after genocide have now grown. Some of them have found jobs and others are still looking for them. Life is better today. Today, we have passed the bad times because even God Himself has spared us and we are alive today. If they were alive and I met them today, I think it would be easy for me to forgive them. For a country to get reconciled, people need assistance. Rwanda reached an extent where people must be retaught the necessity of peaceful coexistence. In a small country like this, it is necessary for people to be reconciled. We share everything in this country. My view of a reconciled nation is for everybody to feel that they are all citizens, brothers who share everything and work together.
That was Immaculée Mukantabana, a survivor of Rwanda's genocide 25 years ago. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bonsa Tufa, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.